Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career. All right, welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Shankleberg and Kirk Gray. Hey, Kirk.
Hey, Fred. It's good to hear your voice again.
Yeah. So we just ran into a Microsoft issue. I was talking about it on the last episode, is that it's always software. Well, Skype can't get around this one. It's obviously software somewhere in the system. But when you think about it, I mean, we've got computer systems and all of the hardware software that's on those. We have networking connections, the network itself, all of the routers and systems that make that all work. There's packets of files and audio files being recorded in various places. Right. It's just mind-boggling how complex this really is. And most of the time it just works.
Most of the time it just works. What's really amazing is how many different pieces of hardware the same software has to run on. You know, HP and Dell and Lenovo and all that. They use different parts and they use different manufacturing processes, but the software is supposed to run the same on identical on each. And they don't make a different model of Skype for each manufacturer. It all is supposed to run on Microsoft or under the operating system the same. That's right. And that's where I find a big gap in the whole industry is between software and hardware interactions. But we're not here to talk about that today.
No.
And glad you got your system working.
Yeah, I'm glad it's all up. But I'm going to blame it on Microsoft anyway because they bought Skype and it's starting to show, guys. It's starting to show if they're listening.
Speaking of Microsoft, are they going to be at – do we see any – software vendors at the RAMs coming up in January that we'll be attending?
Well, ReliaSoft usually is there, and Item Software, and a handful of the other reliability tools vendors are often there.
Right.
And Anne Marie.
Anybody focused on reliability?
Yeah, Anne Marie. Anne Marie, I want to say Neufelder, but I'm really not sure on the last name. She's like the preeminent software reliability consultant and engineer. She's had a booth there a couple of times now, and I think she's doing papers or presentations also. It's not a big presence in the papers and tutorials and everything else. Uh-huh. It's mentioned, it's acknowledged, but it's not the focus of the conference by any means.
Right.
But that's why we can blame them, because they're off fixing things because it's always broken. That's just kind of how it goes.
Well, they're pointing at the hardware engineers too, you know.
That's right.
So, it's their problem.
This morning I subscribed to the Wall Street Journal, and they issued a special report, and I'll have to track down the link for it and add it to the notes, is they had an article that Silicon Valley has lost its innovation edge. And it was kind of a clickbait type of headline, I thought, but I thought, what's going on here? This is, well, the software guys are trying to expand into hardware. And so Facebook is trying to do solar powered drones to spread internet service. Microsoft's, I think, trying to do something similar to that. Google's doing self-driving cars and their delivery drone. Amazon's trying to do delivery drones. And they're saying that the folks that have predominantly done software, like Google, for example, it was where the bulk of the article was written, have the advantage in software that you pretty much have a controlled environment. You know, I didn't follow that premise completely, because software does have to deal in the real world and interact with the real world. And there are things that are out of the software engineer's control and they have to accommodate. But it's a lot less so than in the hardware world. And so what the gist of the article was is that these delivery drones, it's difficult. Because the world is messy. It's not always in a hangar with perfect temperature and no wind and perfect visibility. that the drone is always going to be operating in. As soon as you open the hangar door and you move outside, it gets messy. And they're having all these failures and crashes and stuff like that. So I shared the article today, the day we're recording this, and said, you know, it's this is why there's reliability engineers.
Right. And the article, Silicon Valley Stumbles in a World Beyond Software. And I just had a chance to read some of it while you were fixing your system. And,
good.
And, you know, talked about how cars, the Google cars, still are having a problem with the
with snow.
Weather conditions. Yeah.
Yeah, with snow.
You can imagine. Conservatively. Yes.
Yeah. Can you imagine that? You know, you're looking for markers of where the road is, and the road is just one big blanket of white.
Exactly.
And you lose depth perception. You lose indicators of road lines and markers.
Right.
I remember driving in the snowstorms and blowing snow at night. And the only way I knew I was still on the road was I was kind of between the two banks of trees on either side of me. That was the only way.
Yeah, I think that's maybe where the human mind is superior. But as certainly in a whiteout, nobody, computer, human, there's no good system to get through that.
No, it's not. It's called stay home and build a fire.
Yeah.
But, you know, the part of it is that these software guys are realizing it's not just a quick bug fix. It's not just, you know, run it and fail it and fix it, run it, fail it, fix it. That is an approach, right? And that's kind of the premise of halt testing in a lot of cases. Mm-hmm. But it's messier because it doesn't matter how many times you test in how many fields in Iowa or Colorado or Texas or California or wherever, there's still somebody that's going to do something different. The world is going to have higher winds, more dust, less visibility. Right. I don't know. The permutations of the environment are nearly endless.
And the people will always push, you know, find an application or say, well, if it can do this, well, maybe it can do this, you know, and let's try it in here. You know, whether you take a game console and put it into an RV or, you know, someplace that's, you know, no longer stationary but traveling. And that wasn't really what the, you know, people that do the Xbox were considering at the time.
That's right.
It was going to sit on stationary.
One thing I never understood with those guys at the Xbox is why did they think people weren't going to put it in a entertainment console, in a cabinet? And so I had no ventilation. Why did they think it was going to be in this perfect, open, airy, cool air feed system?
Right. Exactly. Exactly. There's always going to be – and, you know, the customer's not going to really take these things into consideration, and they will put it in situations that the designer never intended or whatever. But that's the whole bottom line of products, and especially in the consumer market, that you can't control what the customer does with it, and you can't – say, you know, it's his fault. I mean, if he expects the, you know, some not underwater, for instance, but, you know, so other environments like outdoors in a shed in our right now 14 degrees Fahrenheit outside, you never know. You know, it could have those cycles, but it's just, again, the end use for especially for consumer products and vehicles is just incredibly widely distributed. So,
well, that gets back to why we often, you know, you and I often talk about halt testing. And one of the aspects that we run into is that people don't understand, well, why do we do this? Why do we run it to failure? What's the purpose of that? And I wrote an article, not on the scale of what this Wall Street Journal article was, but it was on how do you calculate the value to your organization of a halt test, right?
Right.
And so the idea was is that, and it's the same as going back to Google with their self-driving car, is, you know, getting it to functionally work once in a snowstorm is great. Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. Right. That's a nice advancement on a feature set. But can it do it for more than one storm? You know, does the lensing systems degrade or wear out, or does it the next storm a little bit colder?
And is the snow here like really wet and damp and heavy? which would have a different response than a very light, powdery snow.
That's right.
Those would be different environmental conditions that a car would have to deal with. Plus, for instance, an icy road versus a snow-packed road. Ice, last night we had an icy road, and it was incredibly slick with no traction at all. So the coefficient of friction on the tires is really low. That changes all the time, depending on the snow, whether it's sleet or snow and things like that. So you have a huge difference in that.
And so part of this idea of where the value comes from is the dominant one for me is why we do this discovery process is to find out, well, what fails. And so as we take, say, the snow and ice conditions, and you keep changing the coefficient of friction, right? You keep making it slipperier and slipperier. And do you find out when your car is unable to maintain control, whether it's a self-driving car or not, right? Mm-hmm. And there you learn something. And I think the fundamental thing that the fundamental value of HALT testing and a lot of reliability testing, but predominantly HALT, is that in a failure, when the system fails, we have the opportunity to learn something.
Right.
And it's the ability to avoid future failures, is ability to discover a failure mechanism that we weren't aware of before. I mean, that's gold.
Right.
Able to confirm our suspicion of where the weaknesses are. All of those things help us to minimize engineering time, minimize cost of failures in the future. It helps us to focus on the improvements that make our products more robust so customers are happier with the product. But I look at the formula for value is it's not just avoiding warranty costs in the future or product recalls, you know, problems like that. That's just a piece of it. It's also, as a product becomes more robust, the phones now, both the Samsung and Apple phones are water resistant.
Right. And which was
a response to people saying, hey, it's got to be. we're moving it into the bathroom more often. We're moving it into the pool.
Or I had it out in the rain, accidentally left it in the rain. And, and it's, you know, I don't want the phone to have that weakness in it anymore. And engineers have come around to seeing how they could seal the phone. Of course, Apple removed the headphone jack, which got some response of, but that's part of, you know, technology progress is you trade off. You use Bluetooth now and you have a phone that'll survive falling into the sink or in the bathtub or wherever it might fall, probably the toilet.
Probably the toilet, yeah.
And anyway, or left out in the rain. And so that's made a huge advantage. So, and it's kind of, the idea of where do we find in value in increasing its robustness and using HALT to find the weak links in the product and determine by analysis whether those weak links would take little to fix or require a whole redesign, which may be cost prohibitive, is the whole point of the HALT test. Now, you know, the overall determining the value of HALT is very difficult to do on a first product that's never been, that you have no field experience on.
I don't agree with that. I mean, we're gonna set up a warranty budget for this product, right?
Okay.
It's not simply a guess. I mean, a simple guideline is to say it's 2.5 times your retail price is the cost per failure to deal with it on a warranty basis. There's return shipment. You ship them a brand new product. There's some engineering work. There's customer satisfaction type issues.
Can't be quantified.
Yes, they can be quantified. They can
lost
be.
Sales?
Lost sales can be quantified. It's not easy. It's not easy, but the marketing teams, they will come to the table saying, hey, if this failure is not fixed, we're going to lose X percent of our sales. They have the experience and the formulas and the customer satisfaction surveys and so on, and the correlations between those response surveys and feedback mechanisms that tie directly to sales. Now, it's not a perfect science by any means, nor is what we do in predicting future reliability. But we can use that information as a reliability engineer, right? So if For years and years ago, I was working as a manufacturing engineer on the HB printers.
Right.
And the value of improving the design so that we could manufacture it a little bit better, a little faster, you know, the reducing tack time in the plant or right. reducing or improving the yield output of it by, you know, fixing some feature or layout element and stuff was almost never a good argument with the design team because it would save us pennies compared to the cost of actually making the change. So if I asked them to move a component, say an electrolytic or a ceramic capacitor, I needed to move a little bit away from a screw that was holding the circuit board in place.
Right.
Right. So that I had more clearance for it. I could do repairs more quickly on it. Our placement was more accurate. It improved the yield. It was my first argument for it. And It would save us $10,000 over the run of this product line. And And the engineer looked at me and said, if I spin this board, it will cost us $100,000. You know, it's engineering time and scrap right. and all the existing stuff we have sure. to do and all the requalification, everything else. It's going to cost us a bunch of money. So it's not enough. So I went back to my team and they said, well, if it's next to that screw, the reason you want to really move that is so that you don't crack the capacitors. And I says, well, how often is that? So we did a study, right? We looked at different torques and we came up with the variability of our assembly process. And we used that then to estimate how often we had enough force to cause a crack. Okay. And if it cracked, it would fail in the field. Okay. It might take it a while to fail in right. the field, but once it cracks there with some thermal cycling, that capacitor would fail. And it was on a circuit that would affect the performance.
Okay.
So a little bit of work, right? But we knew what the failure mechanism was. We knew if we cracked these capacitors, that was bad. We had to figure out how often it would happen. That took a little research. And then the last piece was, well, what's the cost of a failure? So we did some more work with the field service guys and the marketing guys, and we added up and we came up with it. I don't remember the exact number, but it was like 2.5 times retail cost. And then we had a percentage of how often it would fail.
Okay.
And so I went back to the designer and said, if you move this, you know, 5 millimeters further away or whatever it was, it will save us $8.7 million in the run of this product in avoiding future failures.
Okay.
And he was like, where's that number coming from? And then we laid it out in front of him and he goes, okay, I can't argue with that. Let's change it. And so the $100,000 became an obvious investment versus just fixing yield. So the value of hull testing, when I find a defect, right? And we understand that, let's say it's a cracked solder joint.
Right.
If it's something that will manifest itself in the field, it takes some work. Well, how often will that occur? You might have to understand how often is it a snow? How often do people attempt to drive in a self-driving car on a snowy road at night in Colorado, right?
Right.
How often does that occur? What's the consequence of a failure, right? It's for self-driving
pretty
cars.
Serious.
It could be life-threatening.
It could be. Right.
All right, but more importantly, it could be headline generating. And so what's the consequence? It doesn't happen very often, but the consequences are high. And we can start back calculating out, saying, well, what was the value of finding a defect? Now, the other part of this is that oftentimes we're trying to justify getting the samples and do the testing in the program, right? And the manager says, well, what good is it? What's the value of doing this before I go in, you know, without knowing what we're going to find, what's the value? Well, then I add on, well, not every test is going to find something of value. You might have, say, in our experience, say 10% of the time, 5% of the time, we only find things that we know about. And we go to the fundamental limits of the product. You did a good design, and we know that now, right? That has some value of peace of mind, of delivery schedule, things like that.
Right.
It's harder to quantify. The other part is that, say, 50% of the time, we're going to find a couple of issues that are going to be cost effective for us to change. And it's going to save us you know, based on your product and costs and so on, it, you know, you start looking at, well, what's the average failure mechanism cost you in the field? And I wouldn't say we're going to eliminate it, but let's say we save 50% of that failure rate by identifying it and make it more robust. And I can do some quick calculations saying, hey, if we cut our field failure rate from 5% to 4.5% by identifying two failure mechanisms and hull testing and solving them, it's going to be wildly cost effective. And usually that wins the day and they go, oh, okay. It's not perfect, but I understand the cost value.
Okay. Let me give you another example of a perfect, what I consider a perfect way of determining the value of halt. Take a product that you've been producing, and this is an actual, based on an actual case history that I was personally involved in. You had a product been shipping for 2 years, and you've had a warranty return rate of about 5% of the product. And so you probably call in somebody like
you probably have a good Pareto of what's failing in the field, what issues you've seen.
Yeah, you do. You do. Right. And it was very easy to, when discussing with the top management, showing them, because they had kept a record of the failure analysis, and showing them how vibration and thermal stress would have been very useful at finding these, and they agreed, you know, a cracked solder joint, loose wires or connectors, those kinds of things were easy to you know, determine that they would have been stimulated by the vibration and thermal cycling of HAAS. So we really started out not necessarily seeing what we could do to develop a HAAS. We did, you know, all HAAS should be based on HALT. So we did a HALT test, and we found a wide distribution in just three samples, and one of them was only 15 degrees above the spec of the destruct limit. So we changed that, and then we were able to develop a very quick 1 hour screen for a couple product units. It was not a high volume, but a high expense product. And the customer then immediately after the screen, the change to the design to make it more robust to be able to do a better screen, a HAAS, we were able to quickly turn that on. And within about 6 months, not 6 months, within about a month or two, they saw that the failure rate or the warranty return rate had dropped from 5% to 0.5%.
Wow.
And that was when they closed the doors on me and said, thank you very much, but we now consider this a proprietary process, and we'd rather you never discuss this with any of your other clients. So there goes my sales pitch to the next client of how I could reduce the product. But then they did later agree that I could present this at a accelerated stress testing workshop. And that's the real bottom line. So if you do have a product, if you're new to HALT, you take a product that you may have had field problems with, and you can show that you would have identified it in, you know, if you have some of the product or you're still in production, and you can show that the weaknesses that you've seen in the field are determined by HALT, well, then that's a real direct correlation.
Yeah.
And you can actually.
And the value you're demonstrating is that we could have known. Right. We're probably aware of many of the issues we saw in the field, but it's hard to prioritize it when you only have a few. The HALT adds that dimension of these are the things that are going to occur first or most likely to occur.
Right.
And if you solve them, it goes to that 80-20 rule, right? You don't have to solve all the issues, but you need to solve the big ones. And so what I agree with you is I've seen that a couple of times where you run a past product to check if you would have found the things you already know about.
Right.
And so then extends to, on the new product, the things you find are things that you can take action on now to avoid them occurring in the future. And that's that differential then becomes the value.
Right. And that makes it much easier to convince management, especially if you have a past record of failures in the field on previous products, predecessor products, and almost always there is some similar product that you've been producing that you can look at and see what the you know, determination. For instance, smartphones, they were failing because of water intrusion most of the time. So they started to improve that. But it's not too often that you get that kind of case. But that's certainly when you're introducing HALT and trying to sell the idea of the benefits. That's the most direct way I've done it, especially if they have a good field failure history. And that's sometimes very hard to get. It may be another department, subsystem supplier or something that won't reveal that.
Yeah, and we'll have to – that's a subject for another episode. But so hopefully, Kirk, I think we outlined like three, four different ways you can approach quantifying the value of it. Yeah, some are more difficult than others, but it's essential. And it's not just with HALT in your reliability program, it's in any activity, whether it's FMEAs or design for reliability or process control or whatever. If it doesn't actually provide something useful, well, then you probably really should ask why you're doing it and what's the point. So HALT is not a magical creature, right? It doesn't just poof, make your products better and then you get heaps of rewards. No, you got to help people understand that, and I think that's crux of it.
Right, and you have to actually do changes many times to improve the margins, even beyond certainly beyond the operating limit. I mean, beyond the in-use environment, or the worst case in-use environment, but up to the fundamental limit of technology if you can, and that's where the real value comes from. So.
Yeah,
I think that's a good summary of it.
Yep, perfect. So now back to the audiences that we're going to – I got two requests for you, which is contrary to what I've been reading and hearing about in doing good podcasts, is I should have one call to action. But I'm going to do two, if you indulge me a little bit here, Kirk. Because one is, as the listener to this, what's your experience? What kind of pushback do you get from your team? And how do you help them understand the value of HALT or any of the elements of your reliability program? How do you show that to them? And then more importantly, I'm interested in, well, what do you struggle with? What are the hurdles there? And that'd be great information for us for future episodes. Kirk and I and the others could really dig into those topics and share our experience in those areas to help you overcome those.
If you're at Rams, come.
Go ahead.
See us at Rams.
Yeah.
I said, if you're at Rams, we would certainly love to have a chance to talk with you. And as I said, John Paskowitz, my co-author of my book, or our book, Next Generation HALT Enhanced Robust Design of Electronics and Systems, will be at RAMS in Orlando this January 25th, is it?
It's the last week in January, usually.
Right. So come talk to us if you have a chance.
Yeah, and as I've often said in these shows, is join the conversation, and we're going to bring some recording equipment and set up a place where we can literally sit down with you and talk about reliability topics. And I think that would be fun to get you as a listener to join the conversation. And we might even be in a coffee shop. I'm not sure exactly where we're going to set up, but let us know if you're going to be there, and we'll make sure we arrange some time to make it happen. And that'd be a lot of fun. All right. Well, Kirk, I think you're off to the airport, if I remember right.
Yes. I'm flying to warmer Dallas.
All right.
So it'll be nice.
Enjoy. And we're recording this mid-December, so enjoy your upcoming holidays. For the power of recorded sessions, we're going to have this. It'll be out probably late December, early January. So hopefully in hindsight, everybody's enjoyed a nice, safe holiday season and is looking forward to getting back to work on the first Monday in January. And I'm saying that tongue-in-cheek a little bit, but hopefully everybody has a nice break. And I know some teams are looking ahead to the Chinese New Year, which is, I think, near the end of January, I believe. Early February, somewhere in there. So it's time to get together with friends and family. And
that's right.
What I fully suspect, Kirk, is everybody's going to realize that our friends and family, one, don't know what we do and don't want to hear our shop talk about reliability. So hopefully you have plenty of time to listen to the podcasts and all of the shows over at reliability.fm. And then join the conversation. You know, let us know what you think, what topics you'd like to hear about, and if possible, join us in Orlando in late January at the conference.
That'd be great.
All right, Kirk.
All right. Well, you have a great holiday too, Fred, and we'll see you in 2017.
Yeah, we'll see you soon, Kirk. Take care.
Okay. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.